The lecture of the 27th of July, 1921, Rudolf Steiner starts by saying that the starting point was a discussion or confrontation with the natural scientific thinking of our age. That's how anthroposophy started off. An auseinander setzung, attempt to come to terms with the natural scientific thinking of our age, of our present time. That present time which comprises the last decades of the 19th century and the first decades of the 20th century. The natural scientific way of thinking has taken place not only in natural science itself, but in a much wider circumference of human conceptions. Correctly, it has been emphasized by a one-sided viewpoint that the founders of modern natural science, at the beginning of natural science, the very founders like Newton, Copernicus, Galileo, even a Kepler, were still attached, still believers in an ancient faith, revelation faith, which they have found within their own period. This confrontation between the natural scientific way of thinking and the great questions of world conception actually occurred only during the course of the 19th century. And this natural scientific way of thinking has also in a certain way taken hold of that which occurs not only on the on that which is called the spiritual sciences. The anthroposophy is not the only spiritual science. In the official language, history is also called in German actually Geisteswissenschaft, a spiritual science. You focus on the one side upon the natural scientific development, and on the other side upon the development of the historical conceptions. So you must say, the person with all earnestness and out of the inexperiences of the total human being participates in the last stage of development of our spiritual life at the end of the 19th, the beginning of the century and the 20th century. That person meets, as it were, two cornerstones, of which one of them made a great sensation, but which today has been forgotten. But nevertheless, it continues in living itself intrinsically in the way in which today we handle world conception questions. This particular cornerstone which produces sensation is the well-known ignorabimus. We shall never know. This ignoramus talk presented by Dubois-Raymond out of the 1870s. Dubois-Raymond, who was a representative natural searcher of his time, certainly wanted to indicate the borders of natural science. He strictly wanted to even indicate the borders of natural science. And he concluded that discussion, which he entitled Ignorabimus, with the following words. We quote, natural science will never be able to investigate or establish the nature of materiality, nor the nature of that which lies at the basis of our external sense observation with the intellect attached to it. In reference to this world, we must always confess our ignoramus, ignorance possibility of it. That's what Dubois-Raymond wanted to indicate, and he says if you want to go beyond those limited limits, beyond those borders, then that leads into what he calls supernaturalism, but we would call spiritual science. So once was the question which stood at the standpoint of anthroposophical thinking and observation. Where must supersensible research begin? Or as Warimon calls, where does supernaturalism begin? but that's only one of the cornerstones. The other cornerstone was erected by the well-known historian named Ranke, and again it was a sort of ignorabimus, something that we can't and cannot know, we do not know, and we can never know. Ranke, the great spiritual history researcher, attempted with all objectivity to find himself in the world of history through historical documents. And he said, to be sure, what we see in the course of Earth evolution as one of the most significant inserts into Earth evolution, the establishment of Christianity, the appearance of Christ Jesus in the course of human development. Ranke doesn't deny that this event transformed history, transformed the world, but it was indeed in an historical way it transformed the world. But history has to make a halt before the causes of the arising of Christianity. So you've got, on the one hand, Dubois Raymond indicated an ignorabimus, that people must make halt from the supersensible, and so did Ranke in the historical sense. That which through the establishment of Christianity flowed into historical development, that belongs to the primal elements of historical development. But into this primal development, a methodical historical research cannot enter, cannot reach. Obviously, there are many such primal elements which can be indicated. I just merely indicated that which, as far as Ranke was concerned, was a significant primal element for the Western civilization. That's the other cornerstone. This was erected out of the reason because, in the course of the 19th century, the education which the scientific mankind had received in the course of the last 4 to 5 centuries developed their forces out of the other scientific considerations. Scientific considerations which held their sway over education and over all the other domains of human culture. All these other domains had to adapt themselves to the natural scientific point of view. So you can say that the ignorant business of Leopold von Ranke is nothing other than the historical answer of Dubois Raymond's natural scientific ignorabimus. Good heavens, I can't say that bleeding word. I've got it. Ignorabimus. That's it. Now, when anthroposophical science began to develop itself, it had to confront these two cornerstones. Anthroposophy had to come to terms with the natural scientific way of thinking. I emphasize way of thinking. It's to be noted that an inner scientific conscientiousness, an inner scientific discipline, was acquired insofar as people developed themselves in natural scientific research. And this is precisely what mankind needed. The question is, can this natural scientific conscientious and discipline be continued to its ultimate logical consequences? What happened? The natural scientific research was impelled to work itself out of the qualitative and enter more into the quantitative, to permit as a valid scientific consideration only that which can be measured, numbered, and weighed. In certain circles, it was emphasized that you could arrive at a certain objectivity only when you investigate that which is subject to number, measure, and weight. And when you emphasize that, then in the scientific methodology, it was necessary for you to exclude out of the natural scientific research, to exclude out of the experiment, to exclude out of the observation, anything coming from the subjective element from the human personality. In order to develop a completely objective picture of the world. But remember, what is it that the researcher does? After doing that, he distances himself from his investigation for his experiment, and then he begins to set up natural laws. But natural laws are something that come from the human being himself, and having the slightest part in that which he actually observes as the true existent reality. So he wants to be exact. If you want to be very logical, then you can say, fine, you're going to create a science and you're going to eliminate everything of a subjective nature from it. Okay, then eliminate all your laws, all those combinations which you've introduced into nature, into the phenomenon of nature, because these are purely of a subjective nature. Thus, in our results of our research, insofar as they become a soul good for us, a soul property for us, we have to carry in ourselves something which has nothing to do with the objectivity. As soon as we think, we are no longer in the external objective world. Our thinking no longer belongs to this existent external reality, that external material reality, that sense perceptible reality to which alone you ascribe objectivity. Hence, if you want to really be honest, at the beginning of your epistemological consideration, you should have the sentence, I think, therefore I am not. And you stand upon a strict scientific ground when you oppose the Cartesian error, which says, I think, therefore I am. When you think, you really am not, because you're not in the objective sense world. You're completely subjective when you think. Instead of saying cogito ergo sum, you have to say cogito ergo non sum. I think, therefore I am not. Now this is one of the cornerstones of the modern development which stood at the beginning of anthroposophical science. We had to confront it. We had to ask the question, what now had mankind achieved through natural scientific thinking, through the characterized methodology and inner discipline? Namely, in relationship, if I can use Lessing's expression, in relationship to the education of the human species. Upon that, I would like specially to indicate what there was actually reached in the course of the modern time. If one wants to evaluate it in the correct way, then one must look back into more ancient times of human development in which there had not yet existed a natural scientific sense as we understand it today, in which one didn't at all draw such strong critical lines between that which the human being in a subjective way brought to meet the external world and that which actually was objectively present in the external world. All you need today is to take any kind of work of literature which wants to have a scientific character and which nevertheless belongs to that ancient time which had not had the natural scientific impact, so one will see how man was not then in the position really to separate the subjective from the objective, and which because of that he was not in the position to develop something which belongs to the main development power of the modern historical phase. Namely, this something is the complete ego consciousness, the complete human mindfulness, which inserts itself in the cosmic all and becomes more and more conscious to stand as an individuality, as a personality within this cosmic all. The growth of the personal consciousness, the ego feeling, the growth of mindfulness, that is something which increases to the same degree as the modern natural scientific consciousness comes up in the world. man consolidates himself inwardly, one could say, in relation to all the forces with which he holds together his personality under the influence of the respect and reverence he gives to the principle of objectivity. Man becomes inwardly much stronger as a personality, and his yearning towards a free individuality becomes the greater to the same degree in which the natural scientific consciousness develops itself into the thinking, into the feeling, and the perception of the age. Here you'll find something which is confirmed in that broad literature which you find of our anthroposophical science. And when you study our literature, you can see that the more and more human being arrives at an inward ego consciousness, the more and more he goes up in a natural scientific way into the observation, the working over of the sense world. With these two latter elements, man grows into that which is able to place him in a very secure place as an ego in his whole environment world. In particularly among the technologists, this is felt, because there you can develop a feeling how the human consciousness becomes something different through the fact that one not only looks to or looks towards the confirmation of natural laws through observation, through experiment, but upon the interweaving of natural laws in that which one does in constructing the instruments, the tools for taking this research. In this being placed of natural laws in the reality, one can feel how an inner mindfulness grows precisely under the influence of the natural scientific way of thinking. If one sees into this in the right way, then on the other side, the question has to be placed, under what circumstances does this mindfulness decrease? Under what circumstances does one come out of this ego consciousness? It is noticeable that with the expansion of material knowledge, the ego field becomes stronger. If you go into this material knowledge, so you reach the maximum of the ordinary ego feeling. Now, when does it become weaker? Now, all you have to remind yourself of an everyday phenomenon which shows when the ego feeling becomes weaker. I remind you about the dreaming experience. The dreaming can be made finally as an object of an extraordinary, interesting investigation. And a very important philosopher of the modern age, Johannes Volkelt, made his first literary publication a book entitled About the Dream Fantasy. It's just a very unfortunate thing that Volkert wasn't able to occupy himself with spiritual scientific knowledge. He didn't do that. He placed himself completely under the power of modern philosophy. The person who really studies the dreaming life, so one indeed notices in the process of the dreams many things. But one of the most important signature characteristics of the dream is its symbolism. When, for example, outside upon the street there's a fire alarm and we're still sleeping and we don't cognize the fire alarm as such, so the dream symbolizes that symbolizes this event, places this event in the dream symbolically. So then in waking up, we have a symbolic expression for that which actually appeared as an external fire alarm. This is an example for the symbolization of external events. And so also it is for inner conditions. We can dream of a hot oven and realize that when we awake, that this hot boiling oven, cooking oven, is the dream symbol that is represented for us for the beating of the heart when we wake up. And so both an inner and an external situation can be symbolized by the dream in a remarkable way. But we will not be able to deny that the dream domain represents itself as something in which, as it were, we lose our ego. It goes so far that that which we can only get out of our own ego, that actually our own ego, that in the dream our own ego appears to us as a fremden-ish, a foreign ego. The word fremd, I can't translate, but the fremde-ish. And an unknown, an unfamiliar-ish ego. So the dream brings us out of our mindfulness into that, out of that mindfulness which we more and more grow into when we devote ourselves to external material knowledge. And if one follows that which in the dream shows itself still in healthy conditions through all the phenomena which attach themselves to the dream life. Again, if that which appears in a healthy condition, in a healthy situation in a dream, we advance further and we come to unhealthy situations which reveal themselves in mediumism. Mediumism which leads people out of a fantasy into the fantastic and schwärmerisch, into sort of entrancements. If you follow this path, where, as it were, it appears in a different metamorphosis, that which in the dream appears to us in a characteristic way, so that man is no longer in the position to adequately grasp reality, but he grasps it in symbols, which indeed strives to take hold of reality, but really cannot take hold of reality. If one focuses upon all these feverish phenomena of all that which appears as a pathological condition of the soul life, so you have the other pole. The pole which works upon the ego in such a way that when it develops, it dissolves the ego, that it comes out of mindfulness and sinks down into the unconscious. Now there exists a remarkable connection between these inner experiences of the human being, which first appear to him in a healthy way in dream, and then become more and more in the pathological cases which I've just mentioned. There exists a remarkable connection between this whole experience of, I might say, the human being losing his ego with that which we can call a soul life freed from the body. This shows itself simply through the ordinary observation that the actual soul life becomes much freer from the body. So that we, upon the one side, have this soul life becoming more free from the body. And when then, as one says, we look for the natural scientific correlate to this, then we come to something in the highest degree remarkable. There something presents itself of which I want to mention, something which is well known in external today's science, but is not always given its complete significance. You all know what great influence the more Darwinistic direction of the modern evolutionary teaching has exercised upon the whole cultural and spiritual life of our age. Now, there is one point within the Darwin evolutionary theory which, in a quite curious way, is connected with the experience which I have just characterized. This, which I mean, is the following. The correct Darwinism, which indeed has been overcome in a certain sense by true science, but whose way of thinking still exists in the present thinking tendencies, this Darwinism says, the different forms of living beings have developed themselves, have separated themselves, insofar as there are small, very small changes which are caused only by accident. And these small changes total themselves together so that finally from one living being with certain morphological characteristics, out of that, by a process of transformation, there develops another living being with quite other morphological characteristics. Let's take a concrete example, the evolution out of which lung breathing has developed out of the lower gill breathing living beings. One has assumed that the organ which has gradually transformed itself into the lung is the air bladder. One thus assumed that the air bladder, through some kind of accident, in the first place, suffered a small change. And then, because of all such changes have summed totaled themselves, gradually out of an organ, out of that, an organ arose with a quite definite utility for the external organ, for the external world. An entirely new organ arose, so that the gill activity gradually receded and was replaced by a lung activity. The air bladder changed itself into a lung. But again, certain objections can be made against this principle of small changes, insofar as it is emphasized that such changes through the strictness, the Strengheit, through the orthodoxy of an organ of a living being, such changes must actually be only of a pathological nature. Because even if you get the slightest deformation of the air bladder, so that is pathological. And so that cannot be proved as something having a proper goal. Any small changes of the air bladder has to again immediately be stripped away. And so you cannot say that such deformations can be responsible for the evolution and the transformation of the animal of plant living beings. Anything that's abnormal in a given organ is pathological, and the organ itself tries to eliminate it. So how can you say that these small changes total themselves up and are responsible for the evolution of a gill to an air bladder, to a lung? The essential nature is to emphasize that according to this kind of external investigation, in order to explain evolution, you have to focus upon a pathological aspect, upon that which deviates from the strongly organized aspect. Darwinism builds itself upon such principles of progression which depends upon the divergence, the deviations of that which nature itself sets up in a strongly organized way. Something which in the morphology of a living being is just as strongly organized as one has to look upon the mechanism of a machine which has been strongly organized. Thus, it was necessitated to present the development of living beings upon deviations, which can be considered really as pathological. Stop here. Here we have something that Rudolf Steiner has brought to our attention, which is amazing. It's amazing for the first time, after all these years you study Darwinism, and hundreds of well-developed minds have studied Darwinism. No one has ever mentioned this. Rudolf Steiner comes along and brings this rather simple, obvious point other people have overlooked, and it's significant. Is it marvelous? Steiner continues. Is it there then a wonder that our ego, insofar as it wants to continue itself in the external world, precisely investigates itself to a mindful being, to that which in the highest degree is ordered in conformity to law, and that our ego inwardly is the experience which I have characterized, and that when only a trace of the pathological comes into this ego, so as a sole contrast, you have the damping down of consciousness, the losing of consciousness. One can precisely see a remarkable parallelism between that which wants to develop out of conformity to law, which wants to overcome that which we precisely in external nature or external technology must recognize. A connection between that which wants to overcome in us and that which tears the ego out of the mindfulness which it has precisely reached through the material contemplation of the cosmic, of the world all. Thus we see ourselves pointed to the other pole, and upon this other pole spiritual science points with all energy, because this spiritual science opens itself towards this pole to methods which bring that even the loss of consciousness of the ego is prevented when this ego tears itself out of the ordinary organ or organization which is being prescribed to it as a body. All methods of spiritual science investigation work to the point of tearing the ego out of the activity of the body, but nevertheless not to permit it to sail into unconsciousness, but to consciously lead it into a world in which it can enter without consciousness and illness, if without anything else his organization deviates from that which could be recognized as its conformity to law. Very significant that there in the modern mankind's consciousness there arose namely the holding to the pathological as a principle of development in of evolution. And then the focusing upon that which occurs in the diverging of the from the solid organization upon the floating away of the ego, the verflattern des Ego, des Ich, the floating away of the ego. The ego doesn't flutter, the ego doesn't flutter away, that one thus does not enter and develop a soul spiritual activity in a ill way,
but you develop a soul spiritual activity in a healthy way, that precisely is the striving of the naturals of the spiritual scientific methodology. And this spiritual scientific methodology is now in the very same way strictly developed as external natural scientific methods are developed and configured. The person who has not passed through a training in modern natural science can in the main only develop a nebulous aspect out of the domain of spiritual science. Now the here, what we talk about of our anthroposophical spiritual science, our anthroposophical spirit science, Geisteswissenschaft, should not be confused with that nebulous swimming mysticism or anything like that, which proceeds without this strict inner discipline, which associated with the spiritual scientific methods of development. There are two kinds of things in which in the first place you must focus when you develop the spiritual scientific methodology. The first yield itself towards inwards as a necessary force of our everyday soul life and our everyday ordinary natural scientific investigation, namely the capacity for memory. Das Gedächtnis, Erinnerung, the memory capacity. Rick Mansell speaking. At this point, I'd like to make an insertion myself here. Now, when we look at something, it goes into our subconscious, shall we say, and we call that process memorizing. That's one thing when you memorize. Now, when you bring it back to your conscious, you're remembering. So remembering is different from memorizing. I'm just making this myself. One process of memorizing refers to the process that occurs as you look upon something. Memorizing occurs. And remembering is when you try to bring it back into memory. Got it? That's my own invention. The German word Erinnerung, I'm going to translate it remembering, and Gedächtnis, memorizing. Back to the text. Rudolf Steiner continues. The person who at any time has studied the pathological conditions which come over the human being when his memory, memorizing, is not intact, when, shall we say, out of his remembering, certain points of time have been extinguished since his birth. You can find many cases of that in your studies of psychiatric literature. The person who studies what is the experience of a person as a result of the discontinuity of his remembering process, he also knows how, for the ordinary healthy life, this capacity for remembering is a basis for our ordinary healthy life. But what is the significance of this capacity for remembering? This is shown precisely by spiritual scientific research. We must, in ordinary human life, and also in ordinary science, possess this capacity for remembering. However, if you psychologically investigate, now with an unprejudiced psychology, what is actually contained in this capacity for remembering, namely, the development of this capacity for remembering from the early child years, then you find how the Vorstellung, the mental images which there surface up out of the underground of our soul as memories, they are that which we have acquired through the experiences in connection with the external world. Even though, if in many cases, they appear metamorphosed. Many times they appear in a justified or unjustified fantasy. But if you study the whole human evolution, so you arrive at the fact that in this remembering, something is to be seen as a reflection of our life of experience from our own organism. Just as you stand before a mirror and are able to see only in front of the mirror, and you can't see behind the mirror, so with your ordinary consciousness, as it were, you can only arrive to the surface of the mirror of your soul, which reflects back these memory vorstellung. And how the will plays into it today, how the will takes part in this process, we can't discuss today. We must say today, it's our own organism which there reflects back to us what we experience. We learn out of the same comparative way, just as we cannot know what is behind the surface of a mirror, so we do not know what is inside our organism. Through the special methods of meditation, as they are described in my book, How One Acquires Knowledge of the Higher Worlds, and the second part of Occult Science, it becomes possible, through meditation, to break through the memory, just as you break through the mirror, and then you can also perceive what is behind it. If that occurs through incomplete mindfulness, through a proper culture of the will, and with a maintenance of our ego consciousness, then that leads the human being to investigate and see what is behind the memory. And it doesn't lead us to pathological conditions. Through spiritual scientific training, one is led indeed to perceive what is behind this memory. One arrives at a real knowledge of self. This knowledge of self, which anthroposophical spiritual science must strive for according to its empirical methods, this distinguishes itself a great deal from the poetic mysticism of a John of the Cross or Saint Teresa, even though this mysticism can be admired very much and is very wonderful and poetical. But the self-knowledge of anthroposophical spiritual science is entirely different from that. If you investigate the writings of John of the Cross and Saint Teresa, you find the high poetic aspect in these wonderful pictures. The person who, in the spiritual scientific sense, in the anthroposophical sense, is a spiritual researcher, he knows something else. He knows that out of those undergrounds of the human nature, into which the ordinary consciousness is unable to perceive, is unable to dive down, precisely out of that, those undergrounds, there flame up things which you get in such mystics as into the consciousness of such people like Saint Teresa or John of the Cross. Actually, what in the basis of it, there occur in the human organs, precisely in the so-called physical human organs, in the liver and the lung and the other instruments of digestion, abnormal things are occurring there. You can call it profane, but it's not profane for that person who can see into the situation. Such abnormal things vaporize themselves up from these organs, liver, lung, stomach, etc. They vaporize themselves up into consciousness and become pictures which express themselves in such personalities who are adapted for it. However, the real spiritual researcher breaks through the memory mirror. He doesn't arrive at such nebulous, selfish, nebulous self-knowledge, which is so much idolized in mysticism. But the real spiritual researcher arrives at concrete self-knowledge. He arrives at a living perception of what exactly the human organs are. There, that opens up the path to a real knowledge of the human organization, and the way through which spiritual science also can lead over into the domain of medicine. But that's only just a beginning. If you see in this way into the actual substantial material nature of the human organization through spiritual scientific, through spiritual supersensible forces, then one overcomes the mere perception, the external looking at this human organization. Then ultimately one sees how that which represents the material aspect in the human, which presents itself as something material, of a substantial material, in material nature in the human being, is born not out of the mere stream of heredity, which it just merely has united itself with, but how it's been born out of a world which man lives through before his birth. One is able to perceive on the bypath of material matter, material inner knowledge, through looking into the material inner knowledge of the human organs, one can look into the soul spiritual pre-existent human life. And so pre-existent life becomes a reality for supersensible knowledge precisely through this material inner knowledge, this matter inner knowledge. The ordinary mysticism, which is idealized by people without criticism, the ordinary mysticism, this idealized mysticism, is rather a hindrance to real spiritual knowledge. Now, Rusani continues. Another human force, which is just as well necessary for, in the most eminent sense, for life, as is the memory or the power of remembering, and which just as little should be broken through for ordinary life as this power of memory or remembering, another human force is the force of love. Now, we all know how in ordinary life this force of love is bound to the human organism. It is in the way in which for social life it has its special significance, born in a special life period, namely, at the period of sex maturity. Previously, you only have a kind of preparation. But this love is only a special case of that which we could call love in general, im Allgemein, universal love, general love. Just as sex love is bound to the human organism, so is, in the first place, love in the ordinary sense bound to the ordinary organism. But just as, however, you can tear away knowledge by breaking the memory, you can tear forth knowledge, so can love be freed from the human organism when love, through a special soul spiritual methodology, is done. Oh, God, sorry. It's the first time he's done this to me, this lecture. Simply saying here is this, that through a special methodology followed by soul spiritual scientific, spiritual science, love can be freed from the human organism. What his analogy is to the memory he spoke before, I'll leave you to work out. Look how it continues. One must only now then, not in a trivial sense, call everything platonic love, which is nothing else other than a vaporization out of the organism. But this love, in the highest sense, must be developed through human self-discipline, again through exercises which have been given in the writings we mentioned to you. This love, which in ordinary life is no power of cognition, can be so developed that it can be transformed itself to a power of cognitive power of true intuition. You know what he said in that terrible sentence? What he said in that terrible sentence was that just as one can achieve a power of cognition by penetrating through the memory, so you can achieve a power of intuition by penetrating through love. He continues, when we that which we otherwise devote ourselves in life, which educates us actually in life, when you take self-discipline in hand, when we, as it were, have as one accompany of our self-education, more and more in a strong methodical way. What Rudolf Steiner is saying in all this now, if you discipline yourself in order to make love to a free force in the human organization, then this love becomes a power of cognition. And just as we achieve a self-knowledge by overcoming the memory, so do we achieve a supersensible knowledge insofar as we make love to a cognitive factor in relationship to the external world. Overcome knowledge? Oh, overcome memory? You get knowledge of yourself, your body, your organism. Overcome love? You get knowledge of the external world. Limits of knowledge in relationship to the external world must be there. If they weren't there, there were no limits of knowledge in the external world, then we would not be able to develop love in ourselves. If we were not separated from the external world, so we could not be so separated from our human fellow human beings so that we could not be able to develop love in social life. We have the possibility of developing love in social life because we're separated from other human beings. When we, however, again develop this love to higher knowledge and in a sufficient healthy degree, and then transform it to a power of cognition, then we achieve, just as in one way, the way through the memory we achieve self-knowledge, in this other way we achieve, in this way through love, world knowledge. And this world cosmic knowledge leads us to the knowledge of that world in which we live only between going to sleep and waking up, when we have no consciousness of it, when our consciousness again disappears. We experience a condition which in a certain way is similar to that between going to sleep and waking up. However, we experience this condition in full consciousness. And there we experience a new external world. There we experience no atomistic world which lies at the basis of external sense world. But there we experience not an atomistic world, but a spiritual world. To educate oneself in love signifies making the step into the true reality of the external world, right into the spiritual reality, into that reality which our soul is taken up every evening when we go to sleep, when our ordinary consciousness, which there has been bound to the body, becomes unconscious. Of course, there's a yearning back to that body which lies in the bed. When we rise up to a higher consciousness, then we learn to know that world which we then take up consciously when we pass through the portal of death. The both ends of the human life, they confront us in the first place scientifically, with that, however, much else which further we will further characterize in our subsequent lectures. Today I selected for myself only the task to show how that must be expanded, that which precisely in natural science has been result of an inner soul development, the soul discipline associated with natural science, when it's expanded, must be used. You take, when you want to get a true spiritual science, if you want to reach true spirit knowledge, you must expand that soul discipline associated with natural science. Because not in any kind of dilettantish way, but in a strong methodology, the soul wants to develop itself when it wants to rise up from nature knowledge to spiritual knowledge. Hence, one must also believe that that person who now, out of the complete humanness, wants to make a judgment of that what is yielded to us as material nature knowledge, that person who there ought to recognize that we strengthen our ego through material knowledge, he will also be able to find himself in that conception, that perception, which this strengthening of the ego seeks towards the other side, towards the spiritual side, in which we sleep into or dream into, or which we meet in pathological conditions, but which, however, we can develop itself in a completely healthy way. Hence I believe that the person who can feel how nature knowledge in the correct sense will be able to rise up to a spiritual knowledge that is possible to every human being, but particularly possible to those who have been educated in natural science. Hence I believe further that the recognition of spiritual science will be able to come precisely through the strengthening of the scientific spirit in nature knowledge. Here ends the lecture.